Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 89, The Secret Spiritual World of Children, May 12th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So for me, looking at the lives of children and listening to what they tell me and what my own experience is in their presence begins to go around and around it a bit in a very powerful way. So I hear children sometimes ask the big questions. What are we here for? What's life about? Even at 5 years old, I also hear them have, see them have moments of just blinding compassion, as early as 2 years old, this kind of thing. And both of these things and several others, I think, represent, what we could generally think of as spirituality.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Tobin Hart. Tobin Hart, PhD, is a father, university professor, author, psychologist, and consultant. He is founder and chair of the board of directors of Child Spirit Institute, a nonprofit educational and research hub dedicated to understanding and nurturing the spiritual world of children. He currently serves as associate professor of psychology at the State University of West Georgia. His teaching and research centers on the activity of knowing and examines consciousness, spirituality, psychotherapy, and education. He has served as a director of a school for gifted adolescents, a director of counseling, an academic dean, clinical supervisor, a therapist for families, adults, and children, and as a consultant for a variety of organizations. His latest two books are The Secret Spiritual World of Children and From Information to Transformation, Education for the Evolution of Consciousness. In today's interview, we will be discussing his 2003 book, The Secret Spiritual World of Children. Here's the interview. Dr. Tobin Hart, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. As I was saying just before the call, I've been reading in your book, and I find it to be very, very moving and very informative as well. Now, the title of your book is The Secret Spiritual World of Children. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever read or heard much about the spirituality of children. So in that sense, it has been something of a secret. Why is that?
Well, it's remarkable, actually, to me that we've missed this for so long. I was sort of turned onto this by my own, one of my daughters when she was about 6.5 years old. And you know, I was a good psychologist and interested in research and children and spirituality, and I really hadn't found anything myself either. So I think we've got a very... a kind of adult-centric bias in the way that we've taken up the world. And as Gordon Allport said, for example, he said, the religion of childhood is of a very special order, and it's different, you know. And if we think of spirituality in terms of how children talk about God or how they make conceptual meaning of things or how they use their language, then they don't measure up to the way that you and I might do it, or our listeners would, but that they've got their own spiritual world nonetheless. So I think in that sense, we've been a little narcissistic, a little adult-centric in our way of looking at kids.
Right, adult-centric. Now, I think you've made a start on this, but spirituality is one of those words that can mean different things to different people. So again, how do you define spirituality?
Well, I remember reading somewhere, you know, the the Greek way of approaching a problem is to define it precisely and then move from there. The Hebraic way is to go around and around and around a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, to approach a word like spirituality, we've got to do a little bit of both, and that is to go around it with our direct experience, to draw from our personal encounters, and on the other hand, try to nail it down a bit. So for me, one of the ways I play with it is, or taking on those two approaches, William James 100 years ago talked about the difference between personal religion and institutional religion. And for James, institutional religion is, of course, the doctrines and the practices and the rituals and so forth. What he called personal religion, though, I think comes closer to spirituality, as I understand it, and that is the very intimate and individualized kinds of experiences that one has that in somehow, in some way, open us or touch us in different ways. And that can range, of course, from anything. So let me take the other way up, you know, the Hebraic way. So for me, looking at the lives of children and listening to what they tell me and what my own experience is in their presence begins to go around and around it a bit in a very powerful way. So I hear children sometimes ask the big questions. What are we here for? What's life about? Even at 5 years old, I also hear them have, see them have moments of just blinding compassion as early as 2 years old, this kind of thing. And both of these things and several others, I think, represent what we could generally think of as spirituality.
Okay. How did you get onto this track anyway?
Intimated, my daughter one night, I had a developmental psychology book under my arm. I was, if I remember it right, you know, preparing for a class the next day, and it had a picture of a child on the cover of it. And I was tucking my then 6.5-year-old daughter to bed, you know, to sleep at night. And as I was, gave her the requisite hug and kiss, and she got under the covers, I turned and started to walk out the door, and she said, "Dad, what are you reading a kid's book for, looking at this picture on the cover of this developmental psychology book?" And I corrected her and said, "Well, it's not a kid's book. It's a book about kids, like the ways that they think and things that they like." And she said, without missing a beat, she said, "You mean like seeing angels?" And I said, "Yeah, it could be about things like that." And of course, this was the last thing that this or any developmental psychology book was about. In fact, up until a couple years ago, no mainstream developmental psychology book even had the word spiritual or spirituality in it, which is kind of stunning.
Yes.
Well, anyway, she said, being a good, you know, researcher, I said, "Well, yeah, it could be about things like angels." And she said, "Well, I see my angel." And as a good researcher, I said, "Do you see her now?" She said, "Just a minute." And she lied back on this big bed surrounded by this forest of stuffed animals a good six-year-old girl will have. And she started to move her spine very gently from side to side, as if trying to get it in the right spot. And at the same time, she was taking in these deep, rhythmic breaths. Now, mind you, she had never seen anybody do yoga. She didn't see folks meditate. We were in a household where angels were common parlance, and at the time she was generally unchurched, as they say.
And how old was she again?
About 6.5.
Okay.
I had no idea what was going on as she was doing this, so I just sort of stood there dumbly and waited.
Yeah.
About 4 or 5 minutes later, she said, "Okay, I can see her now." And I said, "Well, what does she look like?" And her eyes were still closed. She was in this dreamy voice lying on the bed. And she said, "Well, it looks like she's got glowy lipstick and makeup on, and she's wearing a blue dress. But she doesn't have makeup and lipstick on. It's just her." And I said, "Okay, well, you know, can I talk to your angel?" And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I'm interested in things like this." And she paused for a minute as if sort of listening internally, and she said, she responded to me. She said, my angel said it's okay. She said, my angel knows your angel. They're old friends. And in that moment, from this little 6.5-year-old, I had this wave of come over me, over my body. My body went into chills, actually. I felt my heart swell a little bit, and I felt these tears come to my eyes. Now, I had no idea what was happening, and my mind really hadn't caught up. And, of course, what we know is that the body often registers information before the conceptual mind picks it up. And so my body knew something was happening. I didn't know what. Well, to make this a shorter story, we proceeded to have a conversation over the next 15 minutes, and she spoke with a kind of profundity that I don't hear usually from the wisest adults I know, certainly not from psychologists. And so that was a joke, by the way, Dan.
Yes, and present company accepted.
Thank you very much. Anyway, she spoke with this kind of profundity, and it wasn't a profundity that was complex. It was instead the kind of wisdom that cuts through the cloud of complexity. Very simple, very to the point, but very profound. And as if seeing things through a penetrating point of view, or seeing things from a greater height. And in fact, Aquinas defines wisdom as just those things, seeing from a greater height or seeing into the heart of something. And that's the kind of information she was offering. At one point I said, well, what does your angel do for you? And she said, well, it helps me see better, and it lets me know I'm loved. And in many ways, this describes a beautiful kind of naming of comfort and counsel. So I have no way of knowing whether she was really seeing an angel. I turned around, gave her a hug after a few more minutes and a bigger hug, and quickly went out the door and mentioned this to my wife, and then got a pad of paper and wrote down as much as I could verbatim. And this really set me on a course asking the question, what in the world just happened, number one? Two, is this kid unusual, or is this quite common? And so this really started a whole reorientation of me and for me in terms of the interest of this.
Yes, and your book is laced with similar stories to that, some in which kids evidently came up with factual sorts of information that seemingly they would have had no access to. And maybe we can get to some of those stories as we go along. But this led you to actually a formal research project where you did a statistical survey of 450 young adults. What were your findings from that study?
Well, what actually preceded that and led up to that was this question of what's the first question, and that is, what's really going on here? And so through both serendipity and also a very concentrated qualitative research study in which I interviewed, now it's hundreds and hundreds of kids and their families, and also looked at autobiographical accounts of historic figures, we began to see some patterns that I thought I certainly had missed before, and some constellations of experience. That then led to the second question, and the second question was, well, gee, are these people unusual, or is this something quite common? And so based on those that qualitative data, we began to formulate some concepts, some experiences, some questions, and then again did this quite sophisticated, I think, survey to try to understand how common this was and how common some of these various experiences were. Experiences from asking the big questions, as I mentioned before, what a good philosopher would do, what am I here for, to experiences of something quite different, you know, this little girl seeing an angel, or at least having access to some wise part of herself. And what we discovered is that overall, somewhere between 80 and 90% of the folks that we interviewed, surveyed, mostly young adults, had experienced one or another kind of event or capacity in childhood. And that varied. For example, somewhere around the neighborhood of 50% asked, 40 you know, 50% ask big questions, they said. On the other hand, maybe 35% or so had profound experiences of empathy and compassion that they described, a particular way of knowing that was very intimate. So anyway, it became fairly clear at that point that we're not talking about a handful of spiritually precocious young people, but instead that this may be the birthright of virtually all of us, and somehow we've missed it.
Wow. Yeah. You also, in the book, you mentioned a survey, you mentioned that there are a number of other polls of adults that had been done, and you mentioned one in England where 4,000 people wrote about spiritual experiences, and I think you said 15% involved recollections of childhood spiritual experiences. Do you know what sorts of things they were recalling?
Yes, similar in many ways to what we had discovered. And this particular survey, when you use the number 15%, that's right. But interesting, in this survey, 25 years ago or so, people were asked or invited to simply write down a spiritual experience. And without any prompting about childhood, 15% wrote about childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. So just that was without asking about
yes.
it. Many of these experiences were what I would call moments of wonder. So William James again talked about these experiences of as oceanic. For example, when we lose a sense that we, on the one hand, and the world on the other, are separate. So there's this collapse of subject and object, for example. And so many of the folks describe these profound peak experiences, as Maslow would have named them,
yes.
In which we have this sense of unity or oceanic sense. Many of those were of that nature.
You know, I tried hard to remember any such experience from my own childhood, but sadly, I came up with nothing. Of course, I suppose it's possible that some such experiences might have occurred that I've forgotten, since I seem to have forgotten so much else about my childhood. Does that sound plausible?
Well, I think that I think about these things in a couple ways. One are experiences, and another are capacities. And so, it's nice in my mind to, you know, it's really nice to get a very concrete experience. Hey, I saw an angel, or I had a moment of revelation, or whatever it was. Sometimes the things that are a little more subtle and enduring are particular capacities. So for example, one's capacities for, being in awe or wonder as a child on the one hand, or the capacity for, really feeling empathic towards another. And that empathy, literally that word from German means feeling into. And sometimes young people are empaths. They have this incredible capacity to go into another. Another's capacity, rather than an experience, might be one asking big questions. You know, what is this about? You know, how do you know what's true? And those things are, of course, the big questions of philosophy, epistemology. How do we know what's true? Cosmology. What's the world about? What does the world consist of? And so those things, rather than, you know, these profound sort of mystical revelations, which are really, you know, cool and made for good stories. One of the things that I really want to emphasize is that it's not, those aren't any more important than more subtle or enduring capacities, for example. And of course, what all the mystics and sages tell us, or the great ones, I think, is that, you know, it doesn't matter what your experience is, it matters what you do with it, how you integrate it in your life, how you live with more love and wisdom, for example. Some people are peakers, as Maslow would say, and some people are non-peakers. Mm-hmm. And both may be very, very profound, very self-actualizing. I also think it's, for example, I didn't remember any of my experiences until it was my daughters that began to trigger this for me. And the further I got into this, and talking to other kids, the more I would have this sense of resonance and begin to sort of unpeel parts of my childhood that I had really entirely, I don't want to say repressed, but had pushed away at least. And I began to think about some of my capacities, as those of everybody, as being of a spiritual ilk. We can also forget things.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's an author whose name I'm blocking on right now, a fellow who's written a lot in parapsychology, and he talked about the concept of repression of the sublime.
Yes.
And that's kind of what you were just describing, I think. As you said, you began to peel back some recollections of your own childhood spirituality. Is there anything that you could share with us that kind of came that you began to remember?
Well, two general capacities that come first to mind, I think, is for me was that I was one of these kids who was asking questions. I have a distinct recollection, and I had it before, but I had sort of just pushed it away because it was too painful, I think. And the recollection is very simple, and that is, I had a question at 5 years old, and the question was, what am I here for? And I was, and the other part of that was, what's life about? And I didn't get anybody to take my questions very seriously, and I remember distinctly feeling, I wonder if I'm going to remember the freshness, I didn't use those terms, but the freshness of this question next year when I'm six. Sure enough, I did. Wow. And I remember at six asking that same question. Well, I remember this because while I was really interested in my Legos and I really liked football and, life was kind of interesting in some ways, these were the most profound questions, the most important questions of meaning. And, Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, and it's a children's search for meaning, too. And for some of us, that provided the backdrop for everything else that happened in my life. And until I could find some answers to that, I felt like I was just inching along. And not even answers so much, but a way to a space to hold those questions earnestly and seriously. And of course, my family and my teachers didn't do it because that's not what we talked about in school or at home. So that's one dimension. Maybe that's enough. But another was that I was one of these kids that was very empathically sensitive, and so picked up a lot of the vibes, if you will. And of course, became a therapist much, much later because that seemed like a natural natural way to use that particular way of knowing. And in fact, have written quite a bit about what I call deep empathy, or a different epistemic style, one which is very intimate, one which is a kind of more intimate empiricism, for example, in which we may move into a kind of let's call it a resonance with the thing that is before us. And of course, many folks have talked about this. Martin Buber talks about the I and the thou, when we move from observing or being with something as an I and an it to a real intimate participation with the other. Interestingly, this one capacity is the source of a great deal of pathology among young people. For example, if somebody is an empath, let's label them that, or has a very, very kind of permeable sense of boundaries, then they may pick up all kinds of things from other people and not be able to either discharge it or distinguish what's theirs and what's not there. And so when we work with, for example, teens and older folks who have drug problems, alcohol problems, who are alienated in some way, who may be depressed and isolated, that in an enormous number of cases from my experience and those I've worked with, that these folks, those may be the symptoms and their genuine concerns, but in fact what's underneath that, the deep structure of this pathology, is actually that they're empaths, they're very sensitive, and they haven't been able to regulate boundaries in a particular way. And therefore, this compensatory act of drinking and drugs, for example, to try to numb out that sensitivity, or on the other hand, developing a very hostile personality, or a very isolated personality are all ways of trying to cope with a very acute kind of sensitivity.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. You know, I can definitely see how your capacity for empathy and rapport led into your becoming a psychologist and a psychotherapist. But even more so, the other experience that you described of questioning, why am I here, really seems to have set your course very early on in terms of your interest in spirituality.
Right, you are.
And that made me also, it brought to mind while you were speaking, Carl Jung. And didn't he describe having some fairly profound experiences at a pretty young age? Wasn't he pretty young when he was sitting on that rock asking himself, am I the person sitting on the rock, or am I the rock that's being, it was something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly, actually. And again, it's this, children are natural. Many children have this capacity to be really natural philosophers. And of course, the heart of original philosophy was, what are we here for? What's life about? And just those kinds of questions that Jung said, you know, how do I really basically understand and deconstruct, you know, my life, my thinking, and everything else? And of course, for the ancients like Plato, these are always spiritual pursuits. Mm-hmm. Asking these big questions are always spiritual pursuits.
Well, as I hear you talk about this, I feel a little better about my childhood self, because I'm remembering now that that I was a defender of the underdog on in at least two occasions. I actually physically fought to defend. Mm-hmm. Underdogs in you know, schoolyard situations. And so maybe there was a certain spiritual impulse in that. The other thing that I remember is, as a young teen, lying in bed, and I wish I had thought of something so noble as, why am I here? But instead, I would meditate on death and on the finality of it. I would try to imagine myself not being here, no observing ego. And it was like climbing up the ice mountain. It was so hard to stay with that thought and stay with it, but I would work at it and work at it till I would kind of get it, and it would scare the heck out of me and bring me out of it. And yet I felt that was a very important experience, and one that most people didn't cultivate.
Yes. Oh, good. You found it. You found those touchstones, you know, and the first about injustice, mm-hmm. and that sense of defending justice, really, it sounds like, the underdog. And the other is, and that's part of that compassion and empathy, I think. And the other, of course, that profound, sense that you know, that the existentialists pick up so well, right? And about you know, let's really figure out what life is about by confronting, you know, the terminus, you know, the end. And boy, nothing rivets our attention spiritually more than death, I think. So yeah, you found it. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. with your help. Now, you know, even though I have difficulty pulling stuff from my own childhood, as you experienced with your children, one of my children in particular blew me away on several occasions, saying things that absolutely blew my mind with their spiritual depth. In your book, you tell the story of a two-year-old girl named Elisa or Alyssa and her mm-hmm. imaginary dolphin. And then maybe I'll tell you a story that triggered for me. Do you recall that story?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. good. Why don't you run it by us?
She, let's see how well I recall it, right? So, and she's a bit older now. And by the way, virtually all of the accounts in here, and there are lots of them, are ones that I have followed up with personally, so that I, because this territory it's kind of tricky. You know, you want to make sure that things are authentic.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've kept in touch with most of these folks one way or another. Alyssa was just a little tiny tyke, and she was at a workshop, basically, and her mom was sort of doing what moms or dads do during times when adults are talking, and that is trying to take, you know, trying for her not to be disturbing and walking around. And she suddenly said, I need to tell that lady a message, or something to that effect. And her mom said, well, listen, you know, this is, she's talking now, you can't talk to her now. She said, I have to tell her something. I have something to tell her. And finally she convinced Alyssa that, you know, when she was done, they would go up. So anyway, she walked up to her and she said, she began, and you'll forgive me for not getting all the details right, but basically what she said was that she needed to talk to her father and to basically forgive him and to reconnect with him in some way. And it was kind of a sweet way of saying it. And the woman said, the woman came to tears very quickly, this very tough sort of 50-year-old good workshop leader. And she said, I know this doesn't make any sense whatsoever to you, being the mom, but she said she just solved something I've been working on for years, and that is this incredible estrangement from her father and some long-term resentment and lack of forgiveness. And anyway, so her mom said, well, how did you know that, or how did you know to say that? And she said, well, when I need to know something, Kiwa comes. And her mom said, who? Kiwa, it's my dolphin. And when she comes to, when she needs to tell me something, or when I need to hear something, she meets me in the dolphin area, and she takes me for a swim, and then I know what's going on. And so, you know, from the mouths of babes. So, and in this case, and many others, not just in Alyssa's situation, but others, this kind of connection with a source of wisdom, just as Haley did with her angel or whatever, is often very colorful, but often, you know, it has a self-authenticating quality in that the information is so profound. You know, who knows what the source is? We don't have to decide that. But we do know that they're tapping something. They're accessing something. And that was Alyssa's way.
Yes, and in the book you explore the fact that animals often can be a touchstone for children, maybe a kind of gateway, either real animals, I suppose, or imaginary animal figures,
yes,
or so-called imaginary. And that dolphin story, it triggered a memory having to do with one of my sons. We have four kids, and the latter half were twins that we had, and one of them, Matthew, is just, I have a lot of stories about him, and he's 26 now, but when he was, I would say he was probably about 5 or 6 when we took the twins to the aquarium in San Francisco, and we took them up to this dolphin area where you can see, where you're sort of underground, and so there's a big pane that lets you see underwater and the dolphins swimming around. Well, the room was mobbed with little children, you know, who are all have their faces plastered up against the glass, and they're yelling and screaming and so on. And there's a place where parents are sitting in the background. And my son Matthew went up to the window, and this dolphin came up to him, and Matthew would walk back and forth the length of the window, and wherever Matthew went, this dolphin would follow him. And it was the most amazing thing. I didn't see that dolphin or any other dolphin behaving in that way toward any other child. And in fact, Matthew had a sort of charisma then that he has still today. I could take up the rest of the session telling my Matthew stories, but I won't do that. But to me, that was a powerful, it was like that early experience with your daughter, you know, where, wow, this kind of grabs your attention, and you say, something's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, that there are these moments of something. You know, Shakespeare said more things in heaven and earth than we've dreamt of, and boy, that sure is what we're discovering. You know, our very limited sense of psychology, even spirituality, is really been blown away by the kind of purity of these accounts of and around young people, and they're pure in the sense that they haven't been particularly enculturated, and the motivations and manipulation isn't, well, of course, kids can have all kinds of motivations and manipulations, but these things often do have this, as they say, this self-authenticating quality, like this with your son. Very, very profound.
Yes. In your last chapter, you describe how children, by their very nature, have a transforming effect on adults. You know, adults can be very stiff and into their whole adult world, and a child comes into the room, and suddenly things are transformed. I was in line in Costco, big discount chain, a couple days ago, and the lady in front of me had a little baby, and the cashier was just... just dropped whatever, you know, adult pretenses she may have had and was going gaga, you know, with this baby, just totally coming down to join with that baby in a most remarkable way. And I'd actually like to read several paragraphs from the opening of that last chapter and then maybe chat with you, tell you about a little experience with my 18-month-old granddaughter. So this is reading from your book a bit here. Do you mind?
Not at all.
Okay. I should have given you a heads up, and then you could have read. I don't know if you have a copy close at hand or not.
I do, but you know, you've got a good voice, so I'm happy to hear it.
Okay, thank you. So you write, children can be our spiritual teachers. They lead us to love, sacrifice, responsibility, and all sorts of things of which we hardly knew we were capable. And I have to really echo that. As adults, we often think of our relationships with children as involving our helping them to develop. But they help us grow as well. Development is mutual. There is something quite remarkable about the presence of a child that serves to activate our spiritual nature, our capacity for wonder, compassion, communion, and hope. I'm still amazed to watch what happens to busy and serious adults when a child unexpectedly crosses their path. Our attention shifts when a child enters our busy workplace. Our heart reaches out when we see a child in pain or danger. We soften, even melt, as a child stares innocently at us or looks for a lap or a hug. We stoop down, become silly, want to draw in close, and suddenly lighten as if gravity no longer has the same pull when we are in their presence. These are signs that something deeply special and deeply spiritual is happening. Boy, that really nails it, I think. That was just, and it was eye-opening for me because I just never had looked at it that way, but you know, that passage really revealed something to me. And just to share something personal again, my oldest son recently had to go through chemotherapy, and we have a new child in the family, my granddaughter, and boy, she brought such joy and energy to him when he was going through that chemotherapy. I mean, it was a really rugged course of therapy that he had to go through. But the thing, but it would just totally lighten him when he could be in the presence of this toddler.
Yeah.
And it was very healing for him, I would say. It really helped to pull him through.
I love, good luck with your oldest son. I really love the those ideas, and I love the line that Black Elk, the great Native American elder, who had his greatest spiritual revelations at 4 or 5, and again at 9, and he said, something to the effect, I'll butcher the quote, but something to the effect that grown men may learn from even the littlest child, because the heart of the smallest child is still open, and therefore the great spirit may show to them many things. And there is something about this kind of Zen would call it beginner's mind, a kind of purity, a kind of closeness to essence. Very interesting, for example, for Zen beginner's mind in the book of Matthew, the words are turn and become like a little child, only then shall you enter the kingdom. In Taoism, Lao Tzu, you know, the alleged progenitor of Taoism, his name, Lao Tzu, means old child.
Huh, I didn't know that.
So there is some kind of recognition, you know, and particularly a kind of resonance that happens that you just described so well. And it is in and of itself transformative. Of course, none of this means that kids are no longer considered to be, you know, selfish or cruel or a lot of work or a pain in the butt sometimes. I mean, they're all that too. But that the thing that we've missed, I think, is that this profound spiritual capacity coexists with the sort of normal psychological developmental capacities. And that for us to be able to draw out and refine both of those things, I think, is part of the work of our guiding kids. And of course, as you've said earlier, the work is reciprocal and mutual. You know, we hear the stories about a teenage parent, for example, who has a new child, and they'll often say, oh, well, we grew up together, quite literally. But for anyone who has or is in service of a child, you know, a teacher, a grandparent, a friend, a neighbor, that our development is mutual and reciprocal. You know, we teach them how to tie their shoes, and they teach us about patience, and we teach them how to brush their teeth correctly, and they teach us about love that we thought was absolutely unfathomable. In fact, in my sunnier days, I wonder who's really teaching whom, you know, and how has this really been set up?
Yes. Yes, really. Now, and speaking of teaching and guiding, you do have a chapter called Spiritual Parenting. So let's hear a little bit about that.
Well, again, just sort of taking off on this notion of first, who is a parent? And again, it doesn't have to be biological or even legal parents. It could be anybody. It's that coach, for example, who may not have his own children or may or hers, but who says, look, you're capable of a lot better than you showed me today. I want to see more tomorrow. That may be an act of profound love, or someone else, a teacher who doesn't have her own children or his, or does, and says, you know, I really liked how you asked that question today, or how you wrote that or drew that. And so we're surprised sometimes that the neighbor with a soft cookie and a softer ear is as much involved in parenting as anybody else. So that's the first thing, is that we're all really involved in this if we're interested in it. Second thing is, I think, how I think about it maybe most fundamentally, I think about the job of parenting is twofold. One is to hold, and the other is to behold. And holding means appropriately setting limits. It means, as we would for a newborn, really to hold and protect them, to care for them, to nourish them both emotionally and psychologically. We know from both developmental theory and from neurobiology that early attachment is absolutely fundamental to healthy development. So that's about really holding. That's about really making the world safe for this child to be in, so that they can trust it and therefore have the courage to go out and meet it. But the other side, and this is a side that's trickier, I think, and really maybe the main point of this whole book is about beholding. And that is to expand our awareness to really get to really see who this person, this soul is in front of us, beyond our expectations, beyond the developmental texts, beyond them not taking their plate back into the kitchen once again, you know, this kind of, and so it's beholding in the spirit that you might see a great painting, you know, or a spectacular sunset. Can we see the person in front of us in the same light? When we do, our actions toward them are very, very different. Often, it's like, wow, you know, here you're a being already. You're not an incomplete being. You're already a being. Yeah. You've got places to go. You've got things to learn. I don't want to abdicate my responsibility for guiding you and providing you what I can. But let me see if I can help understand, or let's see if I can understand who you are, and therefore what your calling may be in the world, what your talents may be, what your learning and struggles may be, and be of be in awe and wonder as we help draw those capacities out.
Oh, what a great attitude to project, rather than having a program that the parent's trying to impose on the child. What you're advocating is really being open to their spirit and nurturing it and drawing it out, and that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, as we begin to wind down here, you're the founder and board chair of something called the Child Spirit Institute. So why don't you tell us a bit about the work of the Institute?
Sure. Based on this, and after based on this work with children, and then realizing that this is these children represent a lot of us in the world, we felt like we needed the benefit of and the help of a nonprofit institute. And the Child Spirit Institute is a 501c3 educational and research organization that's dedicated to understanding and nurturing the spiritual life of children, and also those of us who were once children. And so the Institute does indeed conduct research. It consults often pro bono with both other researchers and families as well. It sponsors a number of kinds of events. We just helped to co-sponsor a summit on education and spirituality. We have an upcoming big upcoming conference. It's the North American Conference on the Spirituality of Children and Youth, which is a collaboration between several organizations, but spearheaded by the Child Spirit Institute, and that will be in November in just outside of Atlanta, in wonderful small city Chattanooga, Tennessee. Our last one was in California. We wanted to move it back to the West Coast, and so this is a place. This is an unusual gathering, and this is part of the nature of the Institute, is that we try to bring together people who wouldn't ordinarily sit at the table together, and yet have a common interest and influence in the lives of children. So in this gathering, there'll be scholars and researchers, to be sure. There'll be pediatricians and psychotherapists, but there'll also be innovative religious folks from across the traditions, every tradition virtually. There'll be parents, there'll be some youth there, there'll be public and private school educators. And so, because we know that there isn't one prong in, and that the field is so new, essentially, although growing very quickly, so new that we really want to see what's out there and really benefit from this cross-pollination that, a public school educator and a religious leader and a parent and a child might be able to engender in one another.
Sounds like you've got some wonderful programs. Listeners might want to be able to find out more. Can you tell us the URL for the Child Spirit Institute?
Child Spirit, one word, childspirit.org or .net.
Great. You've got both possibilities covered. Well, Dr. Right. Tobin Hart, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome, David. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Tobin Hart as much as I did. I had a real feeling of rapport with him. You know, I've never met him personally, and I don't always get the same feeling of connection with each person that I interview, but I felt a very strong connection with Tobin. and would love to meet him sometime. And probably part of the reason why we maybe started off predisposed to feel really good about each other is that he's been teaching at West Georgia State, and I taught for so long at Sonoma State University. And these were almost like two sister institutions, even though they're probably 2,500 miles apart. Both were influenced, I would say, strongly by the humanistic tradition. And in fact, the department at Georgia, I mean, Georgia of all places in, you know, in the deep South, you wouldn't expect to find that. But it turns out that one of Abraham Maslow's chief graduate students went down there on Maslow's recommendation and got hired as department chair. And so he set the tone for that department. And they've had a humanistic orientation just as Sonoma State has. And there's been some communication between the two departments over the years, and various faculty have visited one another and so on. So there is a nice history between our two departments, both being state schools, both being small psychology, relatively small psychology departments, and both sharing this sort of allegiance. So even though Tobin and I had never met, we had this sort of shared heritage. His work and his book touch me deeply, and particularly because of the impact of the birth of my twin boys. They had an enormous impact on my life and on my heart. It was at the time that these twins came along, I think I was, you know, I was pushing 40. We already had two kids. We thought we were done with having kids. And these, and then we had a surprise pregnancy. And then it turned out, you know, and I was still young enough to be insecure about my livelihood and so on, a little worried about the impact on our economic situation and on kind of my freedom, just as we were kind of getting free to go out to movies and out to dinner and not have to worry about babysitting and so on. Then suddenly, here comes this pregnancy out of the blue, and I was not happy about it, I have to say. And that's a whole nother story. There's a whole long story I could tell you about the transformation that happened around that. Maybe I already have in another episode, I'm not sure. But a big part of the turnaround was who these little twin beings turned out to be. And one of the moments that's particularly engraved in my mind was when I was shortly after they were born. I remember sitting in the rocking chair, and I was holding one up on each of my, you know, on my chest, say to each breast, except I wasn't nursing them, but they kind of had their head on my shoulders and I was rocking them. I was rocking them to sleep. And as they got sleepy, I got sleepier and sleepier. And it was like their little consciousnesses were tugging on my consciousness and pulling me down with them. And there was this powerful feeling of bonding. And I have to say that during this period of infancy, when they were in our home and they were really small and really young, and they weren't even able to talk or give much feedback yet at this point, but somehow I found myself really energized and filled with a certain kind of joy. And I would, when I went to bed at night, I would just feel all of this love in my heart for them, and the love that I felt I was receiving from them. And even before they could talk, I felt that they taught me a meditation. To tell you the truth, was I was feeling my heart flooded with so much love that I then had the notion, as I was laying in bed, I remember I was laying in bed and I was feeling this love, and I had this imagination or this visualization of what if the love was like a knob on a radio dial and I could turn up the volume. And so I went to that place in my heart and I just focused on opening up my heart more and more and letting more and more of that love in. And I just turned that knob up until I couldn't stand it anymore. My heart felt so open and so much love, and And I've kind of taken that as a kind of meditation. I've tried to teach it to other people. I think really it's a learnable skill. I think I got taught something, and that if you go to this place in your heart and you imagine volume control and you just connect with that place of love and joy in your own heart, and you imagine turning up the volume and just feeling that increase and well up inside you, I think you might experience the same thing that I did. I've tried to pass it on to other people, and now I'm passing it on to you. Now, there are a couple of stories I'm just going to have to share with you because they fit so well with the themes that Tobin was talking about. And so first, let me tell you about little twin Christopher. I have to tell you, these guys are now young adults, okay? But here's Christopher when he was just a baby, before he could even really talk. He's on the changing table, and I'm changing his diaper, and he starts making faces at me. He pulls the funniest faces and just cracked me up, and it cracked him up. And so he became this really funny little clown who would pull faces at the most unexpected time just to get that reaction. And it was so wonderful to watch. And also that very special moment when little Christopher and little Matthew were side by side in these little sort of like car seats that you sit on a table to feed them. And that moment when they first became aware of one another. And I think, again, it was that Christopher did something funny. He noticed his brother, that there was another out there, and he did something funny that got them both laughing. And so that was a very special moment. And that's part of Christopher's great gift that he has even to this day, of having a wonderful sense of humor that can lighten the situation up and lighten people up. And I already told you one story in the interview. You heard a story about Matthew and the dolphins. And there's another very special story that I have to share with you. At this point, Matthew is old enough to be verbal, but still in a crib and still in those jammies, you know, that one-piece jammies that have feet in them. And I'm lifting him up out of the crib to change him or something. But I remember he's in his jammies. I'm lifting him up out of the crib. And as I'm holding him up in the air, kind of at my eye level, he's looking at me right in the eyes, and he says, "Daddy, I wish you were my age." And I look at him and I say, "Oh, you know, why is that?" And he said, "Because then we'd both be Matthew." And that just cut through to the center of me, because what I heard in that was so much love and the desire that we could just be one. And I looked back at him in his little eyes and I said, "Matthew, we're already both Matthew." And I'll never forget that moment. In that moment, I felt like I had met the Buddha. And sometimes I say that, you know, I was a tough case and I needed to be smacked upside the head with a 2x4 of love.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
As I mentioned in the last show, I entered a contest to be the next host for National Public Radio here in the U.S., which is the intellectually prestigious network. And I would love to have an affiliation with them. And you can support me by voting for me on their website, which you'll find at www.publicradioquest.com /node/205. And you might have to register on the site to vote, but it doesn't take long. Several of you have voted, and I really want to thank you for that. One of the things that I'm wondering is whether or not you'd like to have transcriptions of the interviews on Shrink Wrap Radio. It turns out that there is a company, a website, that would be willing to create these transcripts, and you would be able to obtain them, I think, for a small charge. I doubt that it would be that much. If you are interested in this option, you need to write to send an email to this company and let them know that this is something that you would like for Shrink Wrap Radio. And you would send that email to content@podsinprint.com. That's content@podsinprint.com. This is show number 89, and so show number 100 isn't very far away. And so, you know, I'm asking for celebratory audio messages of one sort or another. And then don't forget that we also have this contest going on in which I will mail the winner a copy of the book Warriors, Settlers, and Nomads by Terrence Watts, a recent guest, and for the best transition little MP3 type clip that I get. So you can send an MP3 file to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can click on the My Chingo button on our website and record it there. Or you can leave a voice message on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, or on our message line at 206-888-2746. I'm very pleased to welcome two new additions to our community on the Frapper Map. First, we have John Moore in Manitoba, Canada, who writes that he thoroughly enjoys the engaging content during his commutes. And then we hear from Dr. Stephen F. Myler in Shanghai, China, who writes that he is a professor of psychology, both clinical and counseling. Well, Dr. Stephen, I would sure like to hear more from you. I'd like to know what you're doing there in China. And you might make a good guest for Shrink Wrap Radio, so I hope you'll drop me a line. And if you're not on our Frapper Map yet, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to the Shrink Wrap Radio Frapper Map. Once again, I want to thank our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. One of the places you'll find this show is at shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com, and you can subscribe to it there. You'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Hi, this is Christopher Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Matthew and Christopher. Those are the two twins that I was talking about who is... little guys brought such spiritual blessings into my life and really taught me a lot about love. Well, in terms of our email today, of our listener mail, I'm actually going to just respond to one, to what was actually a voicemail left by Anna in Israel, who we've heard from before. And he asked a very thoughtful question, and I thought he even answered his own question very thoughtfully. But he was referring back to a number of our shows, particularly one of the early ones called The End of Psychology, and then the one on the brain by Dr. Amen, and the one on the Sinclair method, in which it looked like a chemical compound could lead to unlearning of an addiction. It left him with the impression that maybe we were progressing so quickly in neuroscience and our knowledge of the brain that maybe there would be nothing left for, say, humanistic psychology. And certainly that's a good question, and sometimes it's one that I've asked myself. But let's listen to how he poses it in his own very thoughtful way. He left a really long comment, and so I've tried to boil it down. And so here's about 2 minutes out of a much longer question that he asked.
What is more, it is a kind of reduction of people, of human being, to the biology of him. And this sort of seems to be justified with our expanding knowledge, and maybe I should add to it also our expanding knowledge of the DNA of human beings. You know, I look at it this way. You know, in the past, we had so little knowledge of our biology that the only way we could possibly approach scientifically human behavior and human consciousness was with models that sort of did not address the biology and maybe implicitly excluded it. But once we can introduce more and more biology into the humanist sciences and we can understand more and more our behavior by means of what is happening in the brain, I wonder what is left for traditional psychology. In another podcast, I heard a conversation between two neurologists, and they said in so many words, there's no such thing as a consciousness. It's only the brain. It's only the naturalistic, the physical, and that's it. And I wanted you to comment on that because you're a bit of a Jungian. You're somebody who's interested in archetypes. You're interested in states of consciousness. You're interested in the creative kind, the non-naturalistic kind of psychology, or at least that is my impression. And I wonder if you also feel that your approach of humans is sort of losing ground to the technological or technocratic approach, if you will.
This is such a good question that you pose here. And in fact, it is the very place that my friend Jerry Trumbull was coming from way back in the early episode you referred to, which he called the death of psychology. However, even with all these exciting new understandings of the brain and neurobiology, I don't think it spells the death of a more humanistic psychology, if you will. I believe that the neurologists from the other podcast that you refer to are wrong, or at least secondhand, it sounds like they may be falling into the error of what's called reductionism. We're talking about systems within systems within systems, and so on, all the way down. And different sets of explanatory concepts are appropriate at different levels. So it depends upon what level of the system within systems that you're looking at. There's going to be a set of theories and constructs that are going to be most useful and most efficient for that level. We know, or at least we think we know, that everything's made up of atoms, and I won't even get into their subparticles. But even if we knew everything about atoms, I don't think it will replace economic theory, for example. To try to describe or predict economic events at an atomic level would be inefficient, to say the least. And even though the brain underlies consciousness, I'm not sure that even a very complete understanding of the brain will ever quite equate to the experience of consciousness and understanding things at that level. I think Anna goes on to answer his own question in a really nice way. Let's listen to that.
I still feel that the approach of the model of a human as a machine with a ghost in it, with a soul, maybe with a purpose, at least with a state of consciousness, with some kind of a narrative, self-reflective experience of his life, I think there's something to be learned there. I think there's a riches in that, that if we lose that, no matter how smart we get with the technological, the technocratic approach, we still will have lost some of its meaning, like what we used to say. I'm originally from Amsterdam, so I'm very fond of that city. The city of Amsterdam is more than just a collection of all the bricks and canals that are there.
Let me just break in here to underscore that wonderful example of Amsterdam being more than the bricks that make it up. Just as in Gestalt psychology, we say the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And that's really a key to the answer to the question that you've raised.
And so is the human being. You know, you can add up all the chemistry of the human body to the latest and updatest of the details and understand all those processes, and you can be exceptionally smart in that. And we have wonderful technologies, and probably this is a great blessing. And if we reduce human beings to the machines that we also are, we lose the stories.
Well, I can't say it any better than that. And at any rate, I'll use the cop-out of we've run out of time. So thanks again to Dr. Tobin Hart for the opportunity to interview him on children's spirituality. Be sure to listen to our next show, which will be with Robert Haas on dream language. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.